House Committee on Judiciary, Subcommittee on Civil Law and Judicial Administration, Monday, February 11th, 1 p.m., Hearing Room 357, Public Hearing and Possible Work Section, House Bill 2354 and House Bill 2459.
We have two bills we're going to be hearing this afternoon, possible work session on either or both of them. House Bill 2407 we'll start off with, and Council, ask you to give us an overview while Representative Courtney and Vern Fotz are coming up, and Mary Hoyt as well.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, in 1989, the Oregon legislature passed a law which required persons convicted of certain sexual offenses to register or have their name and address entered into the law enforcement data system, and that there was a requirement that they register for a period of 5 years. That particular measure did not include any sanctions, and the mandate to register lapsed after a five-year period. What House Bill 2407 does is extend the time for sex offenders to register. It also expands the crimes that would require one to register, establishes sanctions for failure to register, and finally would allow a juvenile court judge to require a juvenile to register. You will see in your packet a short memo from me about some issues that I think this bill raises, both legal and policy implications that I felt should be brought to the committee's attention. And let me just go through that briefly. Not to say that there's necessarily problems, but it's not the issues that the committee ought to be aware of. The first one was the concern about whether or not a person could be required to register for the remainder of his or her life, even after the period of parole or post-prison supervision had lapsed, was the first question. The second question was, if the person is no longer on parole or post-prison supervision, to whom should they report? The person no longer has a parole or probation officer. To what agency is the appropriate agency, and who legally can be given this responsibility? The third and fourth questions have to do with the issue of registration of juvenile offenders. That raises, I think, significant policy considerations for the committee to consider, particularly given the 1989 changes that stated that certain sex offenses cannot, in fact, be expunged, and that's something that the committee needs to discuss. And then finally, the issue of to whom, if juveniles are required to register, I think that there needs to be some clarification about to whom does the juvenile or the juvenile court register, how is that information entered into LEDS, and finally, even though the bill includes some lists of factors that should be considered, if the committee wants to discuss the issue of the 36 counties and the various judges, do they want to give some further direction so that there's some uniformity in registration, if the committee is so inclined to move in that direction?
Thank you very much, Learning Council. Representative Courtney, welcome. Mr. Fotz, Ms. Hoyt, welcome. We appreciate you being here. Please tell us about House Bill 2407.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Mary Hoyt, and I had the honor of chairing the Task Force on Sex Offenses Against Children. What I thought I'd do as we go through the series of bills we have before you, I thought maybe I would give a quick overview of what our objective was in the bill, because what I observed at the last meeting or two is that people get into the real details, which we must do, but I think people forget what our objective was. And most of us on the committee, we were not attorneys. We were trying to look at some public policy.
I appreciate that very much. We did run into that problem last time.
On House Bill 2407, I think the committee came to the conclusion after listening to hours of testimony from adult providers of treatment for sex offenders as well as juveniles that the state of the art is not at the place that we have the confidence that the treatment will really ameliorate the problem sufficiently that we can say with all assurance that the public is safe when these people are in the community. And really, that was the intent of lifetime registration, because we are not at the point where we can say with confidence that these people can be successfully treated. Doesn't mean that we want people to stop trying or to find ways to successfully treat offenders, but that we don't have the confidence in the treatment technology right now. And that's really what we're going to do.
Okay, and so if I can just stop you there, because I do think it's helpful to just get the broad objective out front. How does registration address that problem? It's not registration plus treatment. It's not registration plus, it's just registration.
Just registration is only one tool available for the law enforcement communities and people working in the criminal justice system when crimes occur. And we really, a lot of our task force discussion, we would move over into the discussion of supervision because we also wanted that paired with supervision. But the governor's task force on adult corrections really dealt with that, and they have some recommendations in. And I think their recommendations or bills will be heard at the end of February around increasing, and their Senate bills, increasing the time that these people will be on supervision. I think they get up to 20 years. So we were looking at a package.
And then finally, before you go on through the bill, Washington's statute has gotten lots of attention and lots of media coverage. Can you briefly compare what you're proposing with what they do?
No, I cannot. Okay. I mean, we looked at it, but I couldn't without going back and doing some work on that. We looked at bits and pieces. As the chair of the task force, we broke up a lot of our work into subcommittees, and we had a subcommittee on registration, and Vern Fotz, the chair of the parole board, and Representative Peter Courtney, two members of the subcommittee, and so they're here to testify in the detail. And we had a third member, Phil Lewis, who is a member who does a lot of defense work.
Excuse me. I was just looking at the Washington State information. I am Vern Fotz. I chair the Board of Parole, and I am here to support 2407. And as Ms. Hoyt has already indicated in the previous session, Oregon enacted and subsequently implemented a sex offender registration bill. And this proposal that we have before you today, expands and strengthens the initial effort in the following ways. First of all, it increases from 4 to 9 the list of offenses requiring registration. Secondly, it provides for the registration of sex offenders from other states who are released to parole or probation supervision in Oregon. Third, it provides in Section 4 for sanctions when offenders fail to register. It provides for the registration of juvenile sex offenders at the discretion of the court for such a period of time as the court considers appropriate. And it provides for lifetime registration in Oregon, including information about the modus operandi of the offender. And that registration is through, I think as you already know, through the parole officer or the supervising probation officer, only for the period of time that the offender is under supervision. And then there's some question, and I think we need to discuss that. As Ms. Hoyt has indicated, sex offender registration itself is not a deterrent when it's available in concert with long-term supervision, with polygraph surveillance, with intensive supervision, with treatment. It becomes an important part of the mechanics required for managing the sex offender in the community. The Governor's Task Force on Corrections has addressed these other pieces in a couple of other bills that we may be able to discuss later. About 20% of the incarcerated offenders in prison at this time are there because of sex offenses. And sentencing guidelines now requiring that most person-to-person sex offenders serve some prison time is going to increase that number. Most of these people are going to return to the streets. Given our limited understanding of this offender group, our inability to guarantee that we can treat them successfully, it becomes increasingly important for us to strengthen our capacity to manage and supervise them when they're in the community, and I think sex offender registration is one tool amongst a number of tools that we need to implement or that we need to have in place in order to manage this group successfully over the next few years until someday, hopefully, we understand them better, we understand the disorder better, we can find ways to correct the deficiency in the individual.
Thank you, Mr. Fotz. Representative Bauman.
I'm curious, just looking at this and knowing that we're expanding on a policy that we already have really implemented in the state for sex offenders, who has access to registration information?
It's entered into the law enforcement data system, LEDS.
Wouldn't their sex offense conviction be entered into that anyway?
It is, but I think you're putting more, excuse me.
Mr. Chair and Representative.
Now, I don't get real hung up on that, by the way, Vern. You can just
thank you very
right
much, Mr. Chair, Representative Bowman.
Legislative rules notwithstanding.
Your question again.
Who has access to the information? If I'm thinking of hiring an adult male babysitter, do I, as a citizen, have any access to that information, or do do I have to be a law enforcement officer?
I'm Representative Bauman, I'm a little beyond my reach on this, but I think there are statutes in effect that make that information available to certain organizations like school districts. But what we're doing here is requiring that a sex offender, when he leaves the institution, go to the parole officer, be registered, the name, the address, a description of the nature of the offense, how the person behaves as he or she offends, is entered into the system. It's primarily available for surveillance and detection, for investigative work. It's available to local law enforcement officials.
Okay, that answers the question. Thank you.
Representative Parks, we are still to hear from Representative Courtney, too, so.
Do you know what the recidivism rate is for sex offenders?
Mr. Chair, Representative Parks, the answer is no. Without supervision, without surveillance, I can guarantee you it's going to be extremely high. We do have some supervision in place now for many of these offenders. And just from the standpoint of my experience on the board, I would say that about a third of these people offend within 18 months of their release, reoffend, or enter into a cycle that without adequate supervision and some ability to pull these people back a level or two would reoffend.
Does the supervision really seem to be effective, though?
I think supervision with electronic surveillance, that is, with the ability to monitor them through some kind of electronic means, is effective.
Thank you.
Representative Courtney, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Chair Clark and members of Family Justice, just a brief statement. This is probably the gigantic bill before you in terms of a statement that the task force had reached a conclusion that we cannot now conclude as a society that we can successfully treat these people, one, and number two, that we know very little about their lifestyle. That's what this bill is all about. This was the bill that captured those two thoughts dramatically for the task force, which the task force was not there when they began at all. Because if you listen to Vern Fott's testimony, he indicated very clearly that we don't know much about their lifestyle, their transitory nations, where they work, et cetera, et cetera. And that maybe through this registration law, we can even start to get some of that information, which will help us in the treating end. But because of the magnitude of what they can do to a little boy and a little girl, and have done so in the past many times, that's why they got put in the major joints of the state, that we felt we had to recommend this very dramatic and perhaps controversial step. But this is the bill, I think, that while there's a lot of knee-jerking that goes on with this bill, we didn't knee-jerk to this position today, trust me. It was only after we'd heard from too many consultants, too many sex therapists who finally admitted to us, we don't know what we're doing with the adult sex offender. And we know very little about them, and we know very little about what they're like when they get out, that we felt we had to come up with this rather dramatic recommendation to you. So I really think that that has to be put in focus as to why we're even here today or why we offer this piece of legislation. And we have no illusions about it. I think even if you register for life, that doesn't guarantee that the need or the want or the desire, however you want to describe it, that's inside a person, won't arise again in terms of their doing something. But we're hoping it accomplishes several things, all of which have been outlined by Vern Fott.
Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Courtney. Representative Bauman.
I think actually that you're too modest in a way. I am not offended by the scope. I'm certainly not offended by the scope of the bill. In fact, I suppose my concern about this, I mean, it seems to me that what you're proposing is a investigative tool. That's really necessary. Now, maybe I'm going to need some of the more liberal members of this committee to jerk me back into a reasonable position. I look at Representative
Parks. What
are
you looking at?
Well, Representative Censeri has some questions, we know.
Has anyone given any consideration to how this would stand constitutionally lifetime registration?
All I know is that a member of the subcommittee was Phil, the civil defense attorney, who, let me tell you, I wish you could be here today. Trust me, he, I don't even want to use the word liberal, but he is very sensitive about civil rights and the rights of the criminally indicted or those who have been charged with the crime. And after we had worked it with him, he was of the opinion that, I mean, we didn't run it up the flag, but we haven't gone and checked with the Chief Justice of the Oregon Supreme Court or something like that, that we could get there with this piece of legislation. Now, I'm not going to guarantee you, though, there isn't a jurist in this country, there isn't a court in this country that wouldn't throw this out for constitutional reasons. But we discussed that long and hard and felt that we had come to the point that we could make this recommendation. So that's all I can tell you on that, Representative Sir.
Mr. Chair?
Yes,
sir.
May I comment on that?
Mr. Fonz.
Mr. Chair, Representative Censeri, Washington State has implemented a registration program in which those convicted of an A felony, a rape in the first degree, for example, would be under registration for life. B felony, an attempted rape, 15 years. And a C felony, for us, sex abuse, 10 years. Now, I was concerned about this issue, and I was also concerned about the fact that we don't understand this population very well. And it seemed unfair to me to saddle them forever with lifetime registration when somewhere down the road we might find a key to the answer. And so we have a sunset provision here that requires that we come back before the committee. And I can't remember whether it's next session or the session following.
8 years.
That doesn't get to the constitutional issue, but it does get to a part of the question.
What would happen to people who had been sentenced to lifetime registration in that 8-year window? Assuming that you came back to the legislature in 8 years and the legislature said bad idea and decided not to remove the sunset. Counsel, can you help? You know?
Would they unregister? Is that
yeah.
your question?
Yeah.
I think that the legislature would have to proactively cause the registration to cease.
Representative Edmondson.
Thank you. I just want to make sure I understand a few things about this, which might make a difference, although I like the idea. And it's really following up on that earlier point. It's your intention, at least here, is to treat all persons who are convicted of sex crimes listed the same. There's no option to have your records expunged or anything of that nature that might be available to some categories of sex crimes that would not be available to all on the same basis. Is that a correct statement, someone, please?
That was correct.
Okay, thank you.
But there is we'll wait to see if you get into another area, but that's correct.
Okay. Now, the mere registration with the local officials, is that intended to in any way restrict a person who's been discharged from their sentence, served their time, to restrict them at all in where they might move from community to community?
Well, I would speak to that. I would say, Representative Edmondson, no, that a person would be free to move. It would be required that he register when he arrived at the new address.
Okay.
you do understand that in some ways, we're just curious even where they move. Remember, I made a statement, we're curious to where they move. This whole pattern of lifestyle is something we've got to get a handle on to learn more about this population. But we didn't intend to say it's interesting, because where this comes to play, for example, is someone seen around a schoolyard. And all of a sudden, someone has a police officer at their doorstep who's a registered sex offender asking certain very pointed questions. And we didn't go further than saying you couldn't live near schools or things like that, which I think we had some minor discussions on that. But
Representative Edmondson.
Along the same line, does the registration in any way prohibit a person who's required to register from associating with others, other sex offenders, or for that matter,
Representative
children?
Edmondson, the answer is no.
Okay. Would this, do you intend that such a registration to be an additional punishment to them beyond that of their of the sentence they're given? And if so, I don't want to put words in your mouth here, but if so, would it apply to those who have already been convicted?
Representative Edmondson, in my view, it is not an added punishment. It is there for the protection of the public. A person has committed this offense. It's a very serious offense. And we simply need to know where those people are. And because they have committed that crime, they need to be under this kind of surveillance until we find some other way to deal with these issues. That's my perspective.
Ms. White.
Mr. Chair, may I comment that when we took the recommendations on the road and traveled around the state, we met with a group of sex offenders, adult sex offenders in Ontario, and I really asked them straight out what they thought of this recommendation. The first response was, of course, it's garbage. I mean, that was the first thing they said. As we discussed it a little bit, they moved to the position, well, maybe we don't need it because we've been in treatment for years and years, but other people do. The other thing that happened, we were in Medford, some adult sex offenders came out and testified in support. And one gentleman appeared, and he came from out of state, and he said he was actually kind of surprised that we didn't require him to register. And I think what they were really talking about was the issue of control, that by providing some controls for these persons, that it's really very helpful. That they, if they're not in the prison where they're controlled and confined, that you then set it up when they're in the community in some way, and registration helps with that.
I guess that's why I'm surprised to hear Mr. Fott say that he does not consider this to be an additional element of punishment, because if it's not that, what is it? It's certainly a restraint on my liberty interests. Mm-hmm. And the only way the state can do that, it seems to me, is by labeling that as part of the penalty that you're going to pay for the offense that you've committed, and hope that passes constitutional scrutiny from the standpoint of the just desert to the crime and cruel and unusual punishment. So I don't know that you can characterize it as anything other than an additional element of the punishment. Well, Courtney.
Well, Chair Clark, he was asked what our intent was. Our intent was not for the punishment. Our intent is that we're so thirsty and hungry for knowledge about these people,
I understand what you're
and we
saying.
Know so little that we reached out with this recommendation to try to figure out maybe a little bit more about them so we can deal with it.
Yeah.
But it's not our intent to punish, but I will agree with you.
Yeah.
A court, perhaps every member of this committee, would say legally or technically this is further punishment. But that is not the intent of what we are trying to do here, albeit maybe it is additional punishment.
Well, you're saying what your objective is as a policy matter to try and get a handle on this problem. We're struggling with the constitutional aspect.
One of the
aspect
problems
of
I'm having, and I've watched the way we've made our presentations, and I don't think we've been as effective as we should have, is we got too much involved in the minutiae of bills. And I felt that I did a poor job trying to explain to you where we were coming from in this task force. And so I'm constantly have asked the members of the task force who are appearing before you today and will continue to tell you what our intent is. And you'll have to decide whether you like our intent or, if you like it, whether we've done a good job or bad job in trying to put it into law. So that's why.
And we appreciate that. It's much easier to follow the presentation that you're in the way you're giving it to us today. Representative Baumann.
Just a couple questions. One is, I think maybe it's critical that we define this as additional punishment. Although, what strikes me as unusual about it is that any convicted criminal, except for one who has the crime expunged, has an expectation, I think, of a certain lifelong registration.
Had a criminal record.
He's got a criminal record. That's right. Now, you know, this isn't like, you know, Jean Valjean. We're not going to give these people yellow passports or something. But I think you run into a couple problems if you don't classify it as an additional punishment or a condition, some sort of condition of release. I think you run into penalty problems for people who fail to register under the law. And I also think that that raises, however, if you define it as an additional criminal punishment, that limits us to just subsequent sex offenders from here on out, because you really can't impose something on people who had no knowledge, you know, of this law ex post facto. And we've got a problem registering all those people who move into the state of Oregon having been convicted in other states, because I don't really think the state of Oregon can place a condition upon the travel of a citizen, of any citizen of the United States, who has been sentenced, say, under the laws of Idaho or Pennsylvania or wherever, and fulfilled the extent of their sentence in that state and is now seeking to move to Oregon.
Well, so.
Thank you. Chair Clark, we did discuss, interestingly enough, the issue of whether or not a sex offender should have something on his or her license plate or placed on their house, for example. I mean, let's just get into it. You get into the registration, you get into that issue. We felt then perhaps you're talking punishment. If you know, I think, does everyone in the committee know what I'm talking about, where if you're a convicted sex offender, you have to have some kind of symbol on your house, I am a sex offender, on your license plate. We didn't choose to do anything like that because we felt then you are in a situation where maybe you really are trying to punish further or harass or something. And that we didn't know what that would accomplish in terms of learning something about the lifestyle or the type of population. We didn't think that would accomplish anything. We felt that maybe, even though this is very imperfect, this would help us learn something more along with protecting society. So these are the struggles that we had on that task force, but this issue got us into you have to wear a big symbol on your house or on your clothing or on a license plate saying to all the world, wherever you go, I am a sex offender. So I wanted to bring that into this discussion, too.
At which point you do become like Jean Valjean, as our former English teacher pointed out. You still remind me of Sister Mary Catherine when you talk about English. Representative Mannix.
I'd like to shift gears a little bit here. First of all, we need to remember that we're talking about registration and listing via LEDS, the Law Enforcement Data System, which is, and I was checking the statute, very restrictive about who can have access to the system. So we're talking about mainly an extension of criminal records that are presently kept. If you're convicted in the state of Oregon, the record's there unless it gets expunged. And all we're asking is that the records be kept updated is basically what you're saying. And my question is, why don't we require anybody who commits a felony in the state of Oregon for the rest of their lives to keep us updated as to their address? I'm just throwing it out. Why do we focus on these crimes? We do have other forms of sanctions, if you want to use that phraseology, which follow people to their grave unless they get the court to intervene. One of them is a new sanction we added last session, and that said ex-cons cannot possess firearms. It used to be it was only handguns that they couldn't possess, as I recall, and we extended it to firearms. So why are we nervous about just saying, well, we want to keep people's criminal records up to date if they've committed a felony, and as part of that, they should maintain an updated record, because no one else has access to this anyway. I'll throw that out to all of you.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mannix, we really didn't look at all felons simply because our charge was to look at registration of sex offenders and time limit. That's all I can tell you.
Council has some comments for us that can help out on some of these questions. Learned counsel.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, in anticipation of this discussion, the House Research Department and I spent some time this morning looking at these very questions because I anticipated they would be here. First of all, it does appear that numerous states have enacted registries for sex offenders. California has a lifetime one. Washington starts out with a graduated system and has a starts out with lifetime registration. Interestingly enough, when they have been challenged in the courts, they have found to not be cruel and unusual punishment because they don't, quote, shock the conscience of the community. And one court went so far as to call it merely registering and did not see a problem subsequent to that. However, the one issue that I would like the committee to consider is that it seems like, and this was our cursory first review, that all states, and this includes Washington's, does have the ability in their statute to allow a person to petition the court to be relieved of the duty of the duty to register. For those of you that recall the discussions that we had last session in gun registration and the fact that the persons with felony convictions at some point have the ability to go back to the court and ask the court to be relieved of, quote, unquote, that disability and not and be removed from the registry, Washington has a similar procedure in their
Okay, committee, you need to know, by the way, we lose four members at 4:30, so we're going to have to move along here. Linda Erickson, would you come up, please? Welcome. Would you please identify yourself for the record? And it looks like you are from Carleton.
Yes.
And give us your testimony about House Bill 2407, please.
Okay, I'm Linda Erickson. I'm in support of the bill. I'm in support of any of the bills that empower the victims. This is my personal experience in our state concerning these issues. And I have written it down because I'm nervous and it's hard to talk. In 1984, when my daughter was 4 years old, she told me that her father was causing the reoccurring bruise on her tailbone when they played the, quote, tickle game. I immediately took my children and left our home. My daughter was evaluated by specialists in Eugene who confirmed that my daughter had been sexually molested by her father. My daughter disclosed to me, the therapist in Eugene, and the Lane County Police. She was also videotaped by the therapist as she disclosed. Coos County CSD, which is where the molestation occurred, evaluated my daughter as not having been sexually abused. At the hearing, which was also in Coos County, approximately 6 months after my daughter disclosed, the judge ruled that my daughter's father be awarded supervised visitation. This visitation was to be supervised by her father's mother, her grandmother, who testified at the hearing that she did not believe my daughter had been molested. My daughter was returned from one of these supervised visitations with deep scratches down the backs of her legs. Caused, my daughter told me, when her father pulled her tights off of her when he was drunk. I ran out of money, had to file bankruptcy, and my attorney consequently told me to drop the case or my daughter's father would take me to court, reversing the charges and saying I had molested my daughter. I asked my attorney what would happen if I refused to let my daughter's father take her. I was told I would be thrown in jail for contempt of court and would probably lose custody entirely. During the therapy I provided for my daughter and am still paying for, I recalled that I had been molested between the ages of 8 and 12 by an older brother who is now a Douglas County sheriff. I entered treatment for chemical dependency in 1986 and am now employed by Yamhill County as a chemical dependency counselor. I have been chemically free for 5 years and have been a therapist for 4 years. In 1988, my present husband and I decided to move from the Coos Bay area to this area. We had stabilized in our recovery from chemical dependency and regained our financial status to a point we had worked towards for 2 years. We moved here to get my daughter far enough away that she would no longer be subjected to weekend visitations with her father and to seek quality therapy for ourselves and my children. Excuse me. My daughter is now 11 years old. With the newfound safety and therapy provided her for the past 2 years, she was recently able to conquer the message the legal system sent her as a small child. That message was that even though she trusted enough and was brave enough to tell she was not safe, she would not be protected, not by her mother, not by the judge, not by society. She recently wrote to her father and told him that she would no longer see him until he sought help. She still fears that he will find her and take her, or that a judge will make her return to him. This past November, I visited my younger brother's home in Douglas County. My oldest son was allowed to stay with my brother during the school months to complete high school when we moved to this area. While I was in my brother's home, I observed and heard signs of emotional, physical, and sexual abuse. I have been in therapy specifically focused on my incest issues for over 2 years. As a counselor, I have been trained to detect and evaluate abuse. Because of time, I've chosen to verbalize only the most blatant sign of abuse I observed while in my brother's home. I observed that my 2.5-year-old niece's vagina was red and swollen and dilated. I checked all of my observations with my therapist, who is a psychologist practicing here in Salem, and it was agreed that a report to CSD was in order. This was reported initially to Marion County, who reported to Douglas County. Douglas County CSD treated me so disrespectfully and so abusively that I am now in process of filing a grievance. Douglas County CSD failed to maintain my confidentiality. They refused to check with any of the sources I recommended, including professionals that have worked directly with my family. They only check sources to support my brother's allegations that I am a crazy, vindictive liar. Douglas County CSD discussed at length with my brother the possibility of my report being a, quote, bad faith report, and stated to me my alcoholic, incestuous family history was irrelevant in this case. I was told 4 different versions of the alleged interview by CSD with my son. Although my report included the possibility that my son might also be offending, Douglas County CSD say they spent 15 minutes only interviewing my son. My son's counselor requested CSD contact him, as he recommended my son be removed from the home at least long enough to be assessed. CSD refused to call him. The Reedsport police would not assist me in removing my son from this home because, and this is a direct quote, "We're not so sure he needs to be removed from this home just because you and your brother don't get along." I was told by the Reedsport police I would need a court order to remove my son from my brother's home, and the court will not issue a court order without a police recommendation to do so. I have been advised to hire bodyguards. As I have been told by Marion County CSD, my brother made threats towards me and forcibly removed my son from Douglas County. I have full, uncontested legal custody of my son. This is only the bare surface of my experience with Douglas County. My son is still there. I feel I have once again been victimized by corruption in the system. I am talking about the little girl I once was, about my own children and nieces and relatives I love with all my heart. I'm talking about injustice and indignity. I'm speaking for my clients and patients that carry the same soul-shattering pain. People that have been labeled antisocial, narcissistic, character disordered, borderline, paranoid, multiple personalities, alcoholics, chemically dependent, self-destructive, and worst of all, bad people. The people that I work with in the field of chemical dependency that are able to walk through their fear and denial know that most of the men and almost all of the women we treat have been sexually molested. They are the survivors, the walking wounded. As with alcoholism and all addictive abusive behavior, it becomes subtly ingrained generation to generation, perpetuated by silence and denial. The chemical abuse is secondary, often a symptom. As was my experience and now behavioral fact, children often do not tell because it is shameful. They feel responsible, are told they are responsible. They have done something bad, wrong, shared in the unspeakable night, naive to the coercion. guilty of acts they cannot psychologically and emotionally comprehend. To tell would be to tell on themselves. As I was, they are often threatened, frightened into silence. They have been duped, tricked by the very people they are indoctrinated to trust. Their innocence and safety in a world they are so very powerless in has been stolen and forever compromised. There has not been one aspect of my life not affected by my incestuous past. It has taken years of expensive therapy for me to reach a point where my self-esteem has been adequate to operate as a fully functioning adult. I am one of the small number of people touched by this grace. Please imagine, if you will, a small child, possibly your own child, telling you they have been sexually molested, and because of a system that fails to understand or support this child, you are rendered powerless to protect them. You are unable to fulfill the commitment that all children have a God-given right to be protected, to be safe. Then imagine that you have been given this burden not once in your lifetime, but twice or more. Society, you, me, all of us have become numb to the act of murder. We accept this as a fact of life. We have no problem believing the statistics or watching hundreds of acts of violence and murder on TV or in the movies. But adults who have sex with children, who commit the crime of soul murder, we turn our heads to, our backs to, our eyes from the horror. Adult perpetrators remain children emotionally, frozen by whatever violation their psyche endured. It is not difficult for me to comprehend that they would feel most comfortable relating with a child. They deserve mercy also, as their spirits have also been utterly demeaned. We wonder why our prisons are full and our society is riddled by the disease of addiction until we begin to listen to and value our most precious resource, our children. We will continue to murder our society's chances for a stable, enriched future. If any of you were to attend a group therapy session of incest or sexual abuse survivors, you would never again question the statistics or truth of this horrendous betrayal. Please, please hear the pain. I no longer have the luxury of ignorance or denial. My 4-year-old niece's pleading eyes and hopeful small voice, as she told me when I left her that she would no longer be okay, will be forever imprinted on my mind and heart. Please open yours. Thank you.
Ms. Erickson, I want to thank you for bringing your testimony to us. We need to hear that story. And we also want to thank you for the courage and grace and dignity with which you brought it to us. We will be in a, we will adjourn for the day. We will revisit these bills, both of these bills, in about a week, I think, Council. We lose four members at 4:30, so this seems like an appropriate time to stop. Committee, I want to thank you for your hard work today, your discerning questions, and we want to thank members of the public who are here as well. Nothing further to come before the committee. We are adjourned.